This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Matt Pegas, and we're going to be discussing my essay, biographical essay I wrote on Substack, contrasting my political journey with that of Richard Hernania, Matt, and how I became who I am as a woke Chad centrist. Matt, great having you on to discuss this or to sort of interview me, I guess.
Yeah, to discuss and to interview you. This article you wrote has been a long time coming. I encouraged you to write,
a book,
which I still encourage you to
which
do.
Which I don't know. I'm on the fence about
enough.
That.
Fair enough.
I'm
certainly
not that
this
interesting
good...
to write a whole, no one's going to want to read my autobiography.
I may beg to differ, but in addition to an auto bio, my encouragement was always to write a little bit of a insider's history of, you know, the alt-right at one point, or, you know, whatever you want to call it now. I know that you never identify with that label, to be clear. But as you get into in the article, you know, you were downstream of it at a certain point, and I just think there were topics. You've been around different online political subcultures enough that I could imagine a multi-chapter, semi-autobiographical, just non-fiction-style book about, you know, an insider's look and someone with a head for.
I'm sure someone's
ideologies.
Already wrote that. Unless I don't know.
I'm
actually.
Not so sure. I mean, and also one. I don't mean to lead off the conversation talking about something that you didn't write. We're here to talk about something that you did write, and we'll get into it. It's related to what we're talking about here. But I don't think it's been written. There's, you know, Kill All Normies is maybe the best book about, you know, the dissident right, shall we call it? Because Angela Nagel is interesting and sympathetic to a certain degree, but that was still like an academic outsider looking in. I don't think it would pretty much be you or Hanania, because no one's going to read Richard Spencer's book. One sec. Sorry, I just heard a noise. My cat's going bonkers. I don't know why, but she's all right. No one's going to read Richard Spencer's book on it. So it would have to be it would basically have to be you or Hanania. And Hanania has a bigger platform, obviously. But both of you, as this article you've written demonstrates, you know, both of you kind of were there for it, assimilated a lot of the ideas.
Yeah, that's
and
true. And
didn't
with,
come out like
with
totally reprehensible.
Hanania, I think that's a good starting point, because he actually reposted it on both the article mm-hmm. on Twitter and Substack, which is great.
Great, yeah.
But to start things off, so he is known for his political transformation, and I'd say like he is fairly like successful as a writer. I don't know like how high up you'd rank him, but he has like 100,000 subscribers on Substack, and he has. Like he's pretty
good,
well,
you know,
known,
I mean,
in conservative circles. And he had his moment. Like, he's not as famous now as he was. Like, maybe he had a moment where he became like the rising kind of star in the conservative movement around the time he wrote, I think he wrote a book about CRT
and
civil
rights. The
origins
of woke.
Yeah, the origins of woke. And so I actually met him in person. We went to see him speak at an event in LA. Yeah. But he had this transformation from more, so he got doxxed, and he had this transformation from being, from his old, more alt-right, white nationalist persona was doxxed, and he wrote for Countercurrents, which I also wrote for, and I think he was writing for UNS, under the pseudonym Richard Host.
Yeah.
And he's transformed himself into like a pro-immigration, libertarian, neoliberal, and I'll read what he wrote in response to his doxing, why I used to suck and hopefully no longer do, in which he admits, my posts and blog comments in my early 20s encouraged racism, misogyny, misanthropy, trolling, and overall bad faith. So he was very apologetic and he went out of his way to denounce his former views, which I haven't done really, and I'll get into that more later. But he is still fundamentally of the right, and I would say Hanania, he is a race realist in a kind of like libertarian social Darwinist sense. But he is fundamentally of the right.
He is fundamentally of the right. A lot of us are race realists, aren't we? A lot of people, even, you know, even some Democrats who would never admit it probably are. So I think Hanania is, and he's, you know, Steve Saylor pilled, but I think the double red pill there is that not only are things that Steve Saylor says true, but also most of us accept it and deal with it without talking about it.
My assessment is he still holds like negative opinions on blacks, but he's super pro immigration for like Hispanics and Asians, which like I have criticisms of that.
Yeah, definitely.
That is I think it's worth the criticisms, but that is like a strain in politics among like conservatives and some neoliberal centrists. But if you look at Hanania, like his detractors, like a lot of them call him an opportunist or grifter. And obviously anyone, I wouldn't necessarily call him that, but like anyone who becomes very successful online is going to get called that. I'm not really a big fan. I mean, I'm not really a big fan of calling people like grifters. It's more like the caliber of what they put out. But regardless, like I'm not going to call him like an opportunist. I actually do think my impression of him is that his trajectory is genuine, even if I have major disagreements with him.
I share that impression. I mean,
I think it's more that he admitted to it. He's embarrassed by his younger self, which is natural, but he did become more personally successful, and becoming more successful in life caused him to moderate and change his views,
which is
very common.
It's very common, and he and Hanania, you know, one thing that you and Hanania have in common besides some of this background is both of you are very honest about your trajectories and just like clear-headed about them, which a lot of people aren't. A lot of people just assume the things they believe because they believe in justice without really regard for how their success or lack thereof in the economics world, in the dating world, all these things, you know, deeply influence people's views. And some people like you and Hanania, I think are as articulated in the article many times over, you know, but you talk about the art world among other things, like you're very honest and aware of it. Whereas some people are A, not honest, but B, not even aware of the degree to which their context and circumstances.
Yeah. That's something like, I want to kind of go in order of the article. That is something I really need to get into later in the article, but just to kind of go back to Hanania, he is an example of someone who was doxxed and a target of cancel culture yet has thrived. So I would say that like Hanania, I'm basically a centrist and an elitist, but that those two words are very, very convoluted. Like those terms, centrist and elitist, mean different things in different contexts. So I'm a centrist in a very different sense and elitist in a very different sense. I am politically homeless and probably differ from Hanania. So he's to the left of me in immigration, or probably to the right in economics.
Right.
But yeah, that's
yeah.
That's basically the way it is. But he did sort of denounce his alt-right background. But like, I definitely can appreciate, like, I don't denounce it. I can appreciate a lot of the higher IQ creative energy of the original alt-right.
Of course.
And even though I never really, on the record, I never called myself alt-right, even though I was loosely affiliated with it.
Definitely loosely affiliated with it, and definitely an early on affiliate and a deep level affiliate in your case, which is something, you know, I mean in a good way. Like you really were there, not at the worst times of like 2017 era.
So like,
I never
went to Charlottesville. Maybe
no. And you
maybe
and you
like there was some degree of it. Maybe some degree of like of association as far as like talking to people who did, but I never promoted it.
Suffice it to say. And this is public knowledge. Suffice it to say, you were on a first name basis with Spencer as well as Greg Johnson, which is than most can say. A Richard Hanania, you know, Richard Host, as it were. I guess he would have been looped in with them both too. But it was a relatively, as you've always told me, it was a relatively in like 2012, say 2011, 2012 when it first started. It was a relatively small group of people. And just as a point of, I think, clarification, I've never really read much, and I could do it right now if I really wanted. I've never gone down the rabbit hole of reading Richard Host articles, but from my understanding, and based on Hanania's own words, you can definitely find them, though. I mean, they're whether or not they're front and center, they can be found. you know, Wayback Machine, whatever, quoted. And my impression is he was, you know, you never were alt-right, but he was. Like, he was a white nationalist and quite a mean-spirited
he
one at a certain point, is my
was,
understanding.
Okay, so yeah. I think the distinction is maybe he probably was more extreme than I was, so he felt more pressure to repudiate his past views. I'm listening to my old shows, like, maybe they're less refined than my current stuff, and maybe they were hosted on sites like Countercurrents, which I'll get to, which is controversial, but they know stuff. I don't think my old stuff really sounds that bad or extreme, to be honest.
Like, it doesn't. Yeah, pretty
like
much.
I did say, like, the main thing is I'm embarrassed by how shrill I came across in some of my early shows. Like, I remember one of my first shows on Voice of Reason Radio, I was complaining about some group. I don't know if they were like leftists or Mexican nationalists who were like desecrating the American flag, and like I was like sounding really morally outraged, and like listening back, I was like, oh man, I sounded so cringe there, and I try to be more reverent. But putting that aside, like I don't think, like maybe I interviewed some people who were very controversial, but I don't think I really came
it's
across
mostly
as that extreme or racist.
No, I'm trying to think, and no, we're certainly not, barely, if anything, more than you are now, which is still, you know, you would ruffle some feathers, right? But not, you're not extreme in any way. You know, you touch some third rails, but you always take a, and I don't mean this, I mean this in a good way. You touch third rails, but you always take a nuanced and shallow end approach to said third rails, whether it's
the Richard Host, like some of the quotes.
Yeah.
They actually do sound significantly more extreme, is what you're saying.
Yeah, although I clarify, I haven't actually read it. I just honestly, I'm mostly basing
it. You saying the articles were smearing him, like quoted some of his old stuff.
I never even read the articles that are smearing him. I'm only going off what he himself said, because I read his article. Why he's a suck, and he used to maybe that, and then I saw. I think I remember one response, and this is probably what I'm basing some of it off of. I don't remember who it was, but it was someone who had also been around these alt-right sites and had said, like, "Oh wow, I had no idea Hanania was Richard Host." Like, that guy did always seem a
but
little
it is remarkable
or something. Yeah.
I think he lucked out because he did succeed despite being doxxed, but his success came before his dox, so maybe if he got doxed earlier, it could have sabotaged his success. But he's became fairly successful, like I'd say among like mainstream conservative or more IDW centrist type circles.
Yeah, and the thing with Hanania is that he's got his own following. I mean, if he was reliant upon, I mean, Blaze TV has gotten kind of based recently,
yeah,
I guess. If he was reliant on, if he was working at the National Review,
he does
yeah.
have a lot of Substack subscribers. But I'm
yeah,
not,
he's a self-made
I'm
man in a lot of ways.
I'm
yeah.
not 100% sure, but I do think he gets back. I'm not 100% sure the details, but I do think he gets backing from conservative think tanks.
Yeah, I think so. And people like Tucker had him on. So he
yeah, like, I don't
part
know,
of this story
I don't know if
here,
it's true or not, but yeah. He's been, I think, like, I've heard rumors that he's back, has been back with the Koch brothers, but I have no idea if that's true. It might be.
I mean,
be.
he's politically, he's aligned.
But he's
so.
Aligned. He is sort of aligned with them. It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, and they know it's a new era, and that's part of. So there's
that's
a few things here.
I like Richard Hanania, but I sort of get the reason people don't like him is I think because they view him as tailoring his ideology to oligarchs like the Koch brothers. That's why a lot of people.
Yeah, though to your point earlier, him. And I've met him. In, well, I don't think I never shook his hand, but I, you know, I've seen him in
well,
person
I
twice.
Actually
I
met him
at
had
the yard,
a,
right,
I,
right.
Like a, not
a tete
super
tete.
Lengthy, but a medium length conversation with him.
Right, and he knew. Did he remind me? I asked you this yesterday too when we first talked about your article.
He
knew who you were,
he knew,
right?
Yeah, he did know who I was.
Yeah, so that may be from your current Substack iteration, but also like Richard. Again, it was a small group in 2012, 2013.
But not,
so Richard Host,
I don't know if he knew who I was from the past. But I think
I bet he did. Would be my guess because it wasn't a big group. Yeah.
Well, he did post one of my articles, the one, the psychological inspired approach to race relations. He posted that on Twitter a while back. But he didn't know who it was. But I'm not sure. If it was from the past.
What's funny with you and Hanania is like you really do have quite a bit in common, despite not having the same views.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's
it's,
even
you're
born.
Cut
he's
from,
born
yeah.
2 months before me.
Right. It goes to show it's not always about what exactly one believes. I mean, I think you guys just have, as your article articulates, very similar trajectories of moving, from one thing to another, of having, you're both super smart, obviously, and just having a very heterodox take. Because, like, yes, Hananya may say things that are more in line with a certain mainstream libertarian point of view, ultimately kind of regular Republican things and even regular Democrat things you hear from him, but let's like his way of getting there is completely heterodox, is completely,
Right.
nuanced and frankly weird and strange. I mean, the guy's a Christian Palestinian, it's just a
Yeah,
strange,
he's like a
which
Christian
you don't have big
Palestinian
from.
who's very,
Yeah.
who's like a hardcore Zionist and fellow Semite now. But I think he used to
Right.
be
Yeah.
anti-Semitic.
I guess so. That wasn't always the most strongly emphasized thing, but I can only assume. I mean, that was, I mean, not everyone was like the right stuff tier or anything, but that was pretty baked into the cake of what the alt-right always was, wouldn't you agree? I mean, sometimes there's branding to move away from it. Obviously, you had Paul Gottfried was a part of it, but a degree of criticism there, or at least of Zionism, was always
So,
pretty
yeah,
integral.
like the
Yeah.
alt-right and the kind of what became the dissident right, like it's really like the quality of like all these chuds came in and just like the caliber of postings really declined. I think this also
Yeah.
applies to like the MAGA movement and kind of like how like same with Richard Spencer ended up becoming very outspoken against Trump and critical of the dissident right. But it's
Yeah.
just from kind of this elitist standpoint. But what happened is like the caliber of people and the quality of content really dramatically implied, and it's because it was initially the small group of people who were maybe slightly autistic but intelligent and creative, and then all these masses of just chuds just poured in to the dissident right. And this also
Yeah.
applies to like what happened to like the MAGA movement and 2016 Trump's like original core 2016 Trump supporters. And what sort of became of that with all these like normie Republicans like embracing conspiracy theories, like embracing like Alex Jones type conspiracy theories and
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, obviously you have a negative
well,
opinion on it, I know.
it's just the nature of the masses and mass media.
Yeah.
So when something becomes big and the masses come in, it just degrades the caliber.
I mean, I think that's accurate. Yeah, I think I have a, and as we've talked about, I mean, I'm not as, I don't even know how to put this. I identify more with that group than you, although I'm clearly not exactly of that crowd
Well,
either. For me, it's like,
you
yeah.
supported Hillary Clinton in 2016. So
Yeah, we can talk about my
before
own trajectories.
I think actually now is a good if you want to just kind of introduce your trajectory because how you came because you came to all this stuff pretty late, and now you're pretty much.
Well, but compared to half the other motherfuckers I talk to online, not anymore. I mean, compared to you, yes. But I meet
So
a
what
lot of
is your
people who, yeah.
trajectory? We've done shows about it before, but if you
We
want to
have done.
just
I'll do it in a
reintroduce it
nutshell.
in a nutshell.
Born Catholic, raised Catholic and reasonably conservative. In high school, became atheist and wanted to be cool, so therefore embraced Obama era shit lib politics. Slowly became disillusioned by that in college, as things got woker as political correctness took off, but still had broadly leftist friends, had all these fights with people and significant others at the time, and was kind of a well-meaning set, settled on being like a well-meaning centrist, where I had certain conservative instincts and I thought the left was going too far. 2015, 2016 rolls around for me, to the extent that I liked conservative stuff, it was pretty neocon-ish, as one is when one is a centrist and one is basically, more progressive in their outlook. Neocon is kind of the natural
So that's
home there. I never would have called myself a neocon, but that's
you
kind of
sort of
where I was.
supported Hillary Clinton from a sort of centrist, more establishmentarian streak.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, well,
So you were
I do
never
have
really, you were never, but you were not really like a leftist per se.
never. That's the thing, that it's hard, and I don't want to
I
get
think you
lost in the
said
weeds.
you went from a normie establishmentarian centrist to more of a radical centrist rather than from left to right.
That's true. Although I would say that there, I you know, listen, I, you know, at the same time, I'm very familiar and decently well read on left wing stuff because I, because of the nature of I was an English and philosophy major and whatever, and I was around super left wingy people. I've read like a lot of the key Frankfurt School type works and Marx. So I mean, there, I. Another thing I think probably you and I have in common, Robert, and probably Hananya and a lot of just smarter, more open-minded people, is that, you know, we've flirted with different things. Like I was basically like a normie centrist in college, but I had a big flirtation with libertarianism, you know, a little earlier in life. I certainly flirted with, I was never like a communist, but I even though I was never a leftist, I was flirting with those ideas. You know, I was open-minded. You know, even though I settled on being basically normie centrist, whatever, but that doesn't mean I wasn't reading lefty
And
views and being
then,
influenced by them in some way.
oh right,
So yeah,
you
but
never,
all
so
of
you
this
came in.
coagulated upon being basically pro Hillary for in a like, oh, it's the honorable thing to do to preserve social stability and like prevent suffering or some shit like that.
And then you did, yeah,
Yeah.
you did vote for Trump in 2020 when I
Right. Because
actually
I
was kind of disillusioned with Trump, and I didn't even vote for him in 2020, and I don't think I will this time either. Because like my vote doesn't really matter in California,
Yeah, no, nor does
and
mine. I
I'm
will
totally
be voting for
disillusioned
him,
with
but yeah.
Trump. But you are gonna vote for Trump
Definitely.
anyways. And
Yeah.
you came into this after the alt-right. So the scene you kind of discovered online was
Was through
more
you.
culture focused, but
Yeah.
I guess, it was very much what came about. I don't know what it's called. Some people might call it the post-right, but you came to the scene that came about after the collapse of the alt-right.
Basically, or I mean, funnily, so I discovered your podcast in
Well, that's a
January, and
good
I remember it
place to start.
well.
You
It
discovered
is
my podcast
January of
via
2018.
the
Yeah.
show I did with Pill Eater and the band Shoo Shoo. You were a fan of the
That's
band Shoo
correct. Yeah,
Shoo, and
I
then you
was looking up.
discovered my podcast from there.
That's correct. I was looking up interviews with Jamie Stewart, unrelated to politics. For the record, Jamie Stewart of Shoo Shoo's politics are pretty terrible. I
No,
mean, he's like
he's a pretty
Antifa
hardcore
tier.
leftist. Yeah,
But like not a
remember Al
smart one.
Stancard said, "Hey,
Yeah.
Jamie Stewart, what do you think about the alt-right?" And he's like, "What do you say? I think they're pieces of shit."
Like I think they should be killed, is what he
He
said.
said that?
And he or I think they should be, you know, is more he said they should be struck off the
Okay.
face of the earth with lightning or something.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even want to get sidetracked talking about him too much. But yeah, I would say yeah, he's hardcore left, and it's not like, oh, he's some Keith Preston type like anarchist. No, like he actually just has he's just like a really angry DNC guy. It's kind of the vibe. So he sucks. I mean his music's interesting, but he you know his politics sucks. So it's a deep irony. It's one of those things where it's almost like something divine was acting in my life that led me to you.
And you
But
were in a not so great position in life at that
I
time, too.
mean, you know, I think I've kind of leaned into the narrative of being in a not so great position in life. In
Or maybe
retrospect,
you're
I don't know.
someone
I was all
who
right. I
has
just
a
moved to
pretty
LA.
normie,
Yeah.
you're someone who has a pretty normie life who wants like the victimhood associated with like people who are alienated. You want to, like, the incels call it being a fake cell. Like, you want to steal their
I
valor.
mean, I don't think I was a fake. So I didn't come on your podcast when we did our first show that June saying that I was an incel. I just think I was in somewhat of an isolated, it was less incel proper, more taxi driver. Put it
You
that way. I was in a taxi
you
driver
just
state of
moved
life
to LA
and I
and
had
you
no
were living
friends.
in a not
Yeah.
so great area.
Well, the area was fine, honestly. I don't live that far. I mean, it was Van Nuys. I'll say that. And it wasn't a bad part of Van Nuys. So it really, I mean, there was things, right? It was just, I can only. It's not that it was bad, it's just that it was a taxi driver moment. That's all I can say about it. It was a vibe, frankly. But it was not the happiest or most socially engaged part of my life by a long shot. I had issues aplenty, but it was not bad, nor do I think I was pretending it was bad. I think I just happened to be in a moment in life where I had to really steel myself and learn to kind of live on my own more and also learn to develop my own views.
Yeah. So
Which
then
is
you
what came
did, well,
about.
you did shows with me, and then you moved over. You did the podcast of Dan Baltic, and then you also have a podcast that's more like more stuff about
Esoteric. I mean,
spirituality,
hey, we're speeding ahead. I don't
esoteric.
want to get topic with regard to that.
I don't want to go. Maybe we shouldn't go off too much of a tangent.
No. I mean, let me just say
it
this.
It is worth talking about, like, how your views, your trajectory over the past several years.
I'll talk about that. Let me just start by saying that, you know, you say I got into it after the alt-right proper, which is true. However, I kind of specifically, let's take the listener back to January 2018 for a second. It was right around the time, it was basically, I think, that month that, like, Mike Painovich had gotten doxxed, and like maybe a month or two or three later, the Traditionalist Worker Party collapse. Like, it's not so much that I got into it.
I met you
after,
in 2018.
Correct. Yeah.
Exactly one year after Charlottesville.
Yeah. Well, so the Charlottesville was bad, but like specifically those first 5 or 6 months of 2018 just were, you know, a continuation of what I guess started the August before in 2017.
So the alt-right was in total disintegration. And we were pushing this thing called alt centrism, which,
yes.
And that
were.
Kind of came from like the left wing of the alt right. And I talked about like people like Anatoly Karlin and Brandon Adamson at the time, and Pilliter kind of too. And that seems
we were kind of
incredibly naive.
I think it seems very creative, but it didn't have these
grandiose kind of ambitions about political ideology and culture and aesthetics and a lot of those early shows we did, but they were a foundation for a lot of the stuff I'm writing about now on Substack.
Well, they absolutely were. And it's as you say in your article, and it's as you said earlier in the show, it's something you regret. Not only do you not regret past views, you don't, or you shouldn't regret the way they were.
I'm proud. I mean, that's something that's around the time when I developed a very strong identity. I'm very proud of that. I just think there was a sense of naivety and grandiosity.
But we were talking about
alt-centrism.
I mean, was there not a sense
of... It was a pretty positive thing that's an alternative to, like, the... It wasn't reactionary. It was something more progressive.
Even as the alt-right collapsed, and even as Trump... People got reality pilled on Trump. Say 2016 through 2019 or so, were years of a great sense of possibility... because of Trump and because of others, you know, there was a sense that you could break through. I mean, it's like, don't be hard on yourself for being naive. I mean, people who have a little more, I mean, I guess Richard Spencer is hard to bring up as someone with a positive reputation because he really doesn't. But at the same time, it's like, was he not naive too for, you know, thinking that he could, you know, the NPI was about to become a thing? I mean, it was naive, but also you have to take your shot when the door seems open. And that's what he did, and that's what we were trying to do. And we didn't become big stars off of it. Yeah, but
it's like manifesting, like the New Thought thing.
Yeah, it is like manifesting, and you know, we didn't become the stars of anything, but we were exercising a lot of creativity. And frankly, and you talk about the MAGA movement declining and the dissident right declining. All this is true, and I'm not here to. Honestly, maybe it would have been better if we could have gotten through this whole podcast without me saying Dime Square, but I'll bring up that scene too, which is far from perfect.
Dime Square,
like,
is worth talking about. Like,
that's kind of what we, not that we manifested it. I'm not going to say
we
that.
We did sort of
stupid,
manifest
but like,
it now. Like, Dime Square
that's
is
the
a
type
brand,
of thing we were talking about. Yeah.
It is considered cringe now as a brand, but I do remember when Dime Square first started. It seemed like the kind of stuff we were talking about, like that's kind of a cringe term. We called it the base Whipple. And it became like a cult, people who were anti-establishment and who were culturally sophisticated, but maybe Dime Square, like that ended up becoming super cringe as a brand and became sort of like the butt of jokes.
Yeah. So what's the lesson in that? I mean, it's kind of like, it's any of these things, whether it's MAGA or Dime Square or all right, like they degrade, but they're still worthwhile. Yeah.
Sort of the Hanani event. Would you say that was like Dime Square adjacent we went to?
I would say it was adjacent. Yeah. I mean, it was moderated by Anna Kachian. So it's about as Dime Square adjacent as you can get.
She wasn't there. Unless you're thinking of another event.
The debate between Hanania and Yarvin?
Oh, the one I went to.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
that is clearly that. But yeah, the other event was a filthy Armenian event, and he's also sort of part of that. So yes, definitely adjacent.
So I want to get
a lot of fruit. I guess I'll let you take back control of your show here and get back on topic with the article. But yeah, I'll say, like, we can talk about how these things degrade and how certain ideas may be naive, and you know, none of these things are perfect, but they all serve their purpose. I've learned something from all of these, you know, whether it's MAGA, the alt-right, or Dime Square. I've picked up elements of my own worldview from them, and I appreciate the role that they've all played in my life. And I mean, as it vis-a-vis you, Robert, what I would say is you've done a good job. Maybe it's not always been your intention. I think you probably would always take, you know, clout and attention if you could get it, but by virtue of never being, you know, sticking your neck out or front, right, and center in any of these things, I think you've been able to keep going in a way while other people have burnt out or sort of ended up like Richard Spencer, where, you know, they're still interesting enough, but they're always on the defensive. And, you know, you've just been able to keep, you know,
got, like, every now and then I have some, like, some wacko going after me, like, really random. I have some random stuff, like Twitter drama, but for the most part, I've never really had people really like target me because of my views. Like, I've never really had problems with that. Maybe by saying that I'm jinxing that, but
no, I don't think you will.
I haven't really been making like political enemies online.
Yeah, no, the stakes are not what some people think they are. You can definitely explore a lot of ideas and touch third rails.
I mean, I've been kind of paranoid myself, but I think people can get like overly like paranoid about that kind of stuff. I do want to get to my background, so I do touch on like the whole like the demographic and class background in LA, and that's all in the article. I think, I mean, that really did shape my views, like how the whole class demographic structure in LA and some of the experiences in middle school to high school that like caused trauma. And I guess I don't know. I really want to get into that in too much detail because I wrote that's all in the article.
Right.
But you came to LA, and I'm just kind of curious, like, your thoughts on the whole demographic dynamics about LA, that part of it, from you coming for as a fairly recent transplant.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely kind of influenced my views as well. I mean, I remember, as you point out in the article, in your first episode, which I have heard, I don't know if it's online anymore. Maybe you've specifically requested that be removed.
I think Pilliter put it on web, on the whole like web archive.
Yeah, so it's there
maybe.
Somewhere.
I linked to it. Maybe that I shouldn't have linked to it, but I linked to it.
No, it's good. It's worthwhile to listen to. And you know, you said in that like one half of LA is like Mexico City, and the other half is like Tel Aviv, which is funny, but not entirely inaccurate. But then, as you say in the article, it's like maybe if it really was like that, it'd be preferable to the way it is now.
Oh yeah, I do say that also in this article. Yeah. Maybe if it actually was, but I guess the point is, like, I think it maybe be healthier if it actually became outright like Mexico City and Tel Aviv, rather than just trying to LARP that it's part of America. And the whole kind of like, or part of like this car oriented like suburbia, like if it actually did, maybe it would actually be better than the way it is now.
Yeah, well, I've been to Mexico City since I first heard you say that on your pod when I sought it out as a back catalog.
I'll be honest, it's probably
pretty fucking nice, actually.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's probably
prime,
much
but, like,
nicer.
Yeah.
The central part, at least. I mean, there's obviously poverty and dangerous areas, but the central core part is probably far superior to like LA's urban core.
Well,
I haven't been there, but urban core.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's better than LA. It's just, it's not like, it's no hellhole. It's kind of nice. And it's, you know, it's
probably much better urbanism, like more walkable.
Yeah, definitely better. Yeah, really nice park in the middle. Anyway,
like
European
style architecture. We don't need to get into this, but but back to like LA, I think the way LA is structured, the class dynamics too. And it is, I mean, there are a lot of opportunities to meet a lot of interesting people, but it can also be a very atomized and alienating place at the same time.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's the atomization of it. Well, it's funny. I mean, again, in terms of context, controlling the way we think about things, like, yes, LA is atomized. It's probably more atomized than the country at large, maybe even a bit more atomized than New York. But that being said, again, I was in a Taxi Driver moment of my life. So, of course, it was going to seem even more atomized to me, and I was going to get more interested in those kinds of issues, like with you know, bowling alone type social, you know, fabric denigration type issues. And I remember when we did our interview with Luke Ford that year, we did that video interview with him. I was kind of leading into like, oh, do you find LA to be an especially atomized place? And he said, no. But that was the kind of thing that was on my mind. I mean, I liked LA then, so I would have moved if I didn't, but I was very much thinking like, man, this place is so atomized. But of course, where does real social atomization begin, and where does my own life circumstances end? I mean, it gets very hard to differentiate between those two things. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, yeah. And I do think like that. Like being from LA really shaped my views. But it is interesting how what I say in the article is I had a lot of these like sentiments growing up, even as a kid, of like liking urbanism and multiculturalism. And I think when I went for these different subcultures from the more, like before the alt-right, it was more the right-wing kind of patriotard scene in the zero-zeros. But yeah. I felt some need to kind of like, because I felt alienated and atomized and politically homeless, I felt a need to signal to more reactionary viewpoints than I actually was. And I think this is very common.
Yeah, it's a seeking for a group by signifying, which is okay. Look, that's a good reason to be patriotic is,
I guess, to
be define
like
that camaraderie, but yeah.
Where I am, like Richard Hanania, like he's much more of a neoliberal, but I have been promoting urbanism and multiculturalism, which if I word it the right way, it is, my views, some of my articles, if I word it the right way, like I could be very palatable to liberals and be in liberal circles and articulate my views in a kind of way that are socially acceptable. Just say, hey, I'm for urbanism and multiculturalism.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think you bravely don't spin it that way because you want to, you know, keep a wider audience. But yeah,
I think now I don't spin it to sound super lefty, but do you remember when I first got on Substack around 2022 and I was promoting like enclavism or ethno-pluralism, but using like lefty rhetoric to promote it? Do you remember that?
Of course I remember that. So would you say that was kind of when you were first getting more serious about Substack, I suppose. When did you get on Substack again, Robert? About
2021? I think 2022. So 2020, I was really shilling my views using more kind of lefty rhetoric, like saying we need to uphold California values of diversity, equity, and multiculturalism.
This may be a beyond the pale of the podcast. Was that really in 2022? I feel like I was kind of like looking
maybe
at articles of you much earlier.
For a while, I was writing articles that were posted on your old defunct All of Center blog.
Yeah, when we did that podcast, but also it was a Substack article that you wrote about, like, issues on the midterm ballot in California. Was that only in 2022? I guess it must have been. Wow. It feels like ages ago.
I forget.
All right.
Yeah,
I'm disrupting from the more normal conversation here. But
like,
yeah.
Multiculturalism and enclavism. How I think it is a bad thing for like white Americans living in places like LA. I do think being in a very multicultural environment, but being atomized, but then also trying to still pretend that you're part of this American middle class is a very bad thing. Like I have been promoting enclavism and what that could hypothetically offer, and a lot of groups already practice enclavism. Like,
would you say that your enclavist era is a former era now and you're on to the next chapter? I mean, I think you still believe in a lot of those ideas, but are you also,
disclaimer, like maybe, like the critique of enclavism is that it would lead to neo-feudalism and it would be bad for advancing civilization.
I think so. I think it's like, yeah. That's why someone like Nietzsche.
It would weaken America as a nation, and just have. Because I guess the argument against it, because like nation states like England and France were much stronger than like the Holy Roman Empire, which basically was enclavism, and that would be kind of like the counter argument. And again, like you can challenge that. Further, I probably will write a future article like listing the pros and cons, and I counter arguments to that. I think enclavism offers like they can be like these Neo-Byzantines in a decaying civilization and becoming like cognitive elite places that do have innovation. So there are different. There's so many counter arguments, but again, like. Challenging your own views makes you sound like, on one hand, you do sound like a cuck, but I do feel like it makes
I think it's good. Yeah.
It's intellectually invigorating. It makes your view stronger. If you can self-critique yourself and improve upon it, it makes you a superior intellectual.
It absolutely does. And I mean, that's all of our trajectory to some extent. Like, but definitely yours, you know, it's the story of that. And, you know, it's rarely as simple as, thesis. Well, yeah, it's not always as simple as like thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but what I'm trying to say is it's not that you regret any of your old views. It's that you built upon them, that you know, the dialectic continues. So maybe it is thesis, antithesis, synthesis, perhaps in a Hegelian sense, you know.
Well, yeah.
You're not R. Derek Black, and I'm not trying to be a dick.
Like he went from being his dad was like a neo-Nazi, and he became like this. Like,
which,
Antifa.
By the way, I do not envy anyone growing up with a parent that out there. I mean, I would probably end up rejecting it all too, if I had that. But my point is, you are not that. You are not a reformed anything. You are someone who's continued to grow in a more and more nuanced direction, which is great, which is how we should all be. And it's the people who never evolve that you have to watch out for a little, or not that you have to watch out for, but that, you know, even people that we sort of like. I mean, like even Alex Jones, for instance, like, yes, he's interesting enough, but I've never really learned anything from him.
And it's
because
like,
he kind of just hits the same note
like,
over and over again.
He,
whereas, yeah.
He hasn't evolved. But another thing I point on, like, I was a fan of Alex Jones in 2008, and I post a screenshot from Twitter of my 2008 tweet, like, really old school Twitter. And the thing is, like, it's kind of the analogous to how someone used to like a band and now they hate it. But, like, it just feels like all these people, like, these people like Nick Fuentes, like there, I have kind of contempt. Part of the reason I have contempt for them is because like they remind me of where I was at a younger age, like way back in the late 00s.
Yeah, fair enough. And you talk about that.
And all these different things like right-wing populism, conspiracy theories, like anti-Semitism. Like I dabbled in these things and now I have like some sense of contempt and almost a bit of disgust. But it hits me on a visceral level because I do feel like it does feel like it reminds me of where I was at a different time.
Yeah.
That maybe I'm not that I've sort of evolved from. But the other thing is even the stuff, that kind of stuff has devolved in its own right. So I'll give an example. Like you take anti-Semitism, it went from just like at least like someone like Kevin MacDonald made like an interesting intellectual coherent argument. But now, like, the anti-Semitic stuff you see on Twitter is just complete garbage.
It is. And, you know, it's become a grift of its own, which is
ironic. It is a grift.
Because,
that's interesting. It used to be, like, being anti-Semitic meant that you were totally unemployable. Now we have, like, anti-Semitic, like, grifters who are actually, some of them are fairly successful.
Yeah, definitely successful within their corner. I mean, it's still not good for your work. But, like, you can make money as a streamer, as it were. And that's the...
Like
I mean, definitely Sneeko, definitely Andrew Tate leaning into that, definitely Candace Owens kind of realizing that there's a green light there. Has to do with the fact that
also anti-Semitism is
quite popular now. Yeah.
Much more non-white.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that too. I mean, even in just what we just said, I said Andrew Tate, Candace Owens, and Sneeko, and I guess even Fuentes, you know, just not even white, yeah. Whatever, but it's worth pointing out. But I do want to say on that issue in particular, I do, I think the honesty that you brought to writing about that is really good, because it's still such a hot button issue that people are afraid to say, like, you know, I kind of did go down this path or whatever, or I gained this understanding of it, or
I'm
have
not even
X, Y, or
like,
Z
I'm not
nuanced.
Being doxxed as like this former anti-Semite. I'm just pretty much sharing, being open about it.
Yeah, and your reasons for it, you know, having to do with the Ron Paul.
I mean, Walt Bismarck, I don't know if you know who Walt Bismarck is. He had,
yeah,
he knows,
I do,
he's
yeah.
another person who had a similar trajectory, and he's been really successful on Substack, and he's been open about his background, and it's been, I think, I've had very positive responses from this article. People really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, you can't, one, the beautiful thing about honesty in fiction writing as well as nonfiction, and art as well as in, I mean, sometimes in some places, even in politics, the beauty of honesty is when true honesty about a topic is achieved, about one's personal relationship with that topic and even just one's honest observations, it gets hard. It always demands respect. And that's very much was my take on this article, is that, you know, it's so honest about your trajectory and about what that means that, like, of course, people who read it, even if they disagree with you politically,
it's
even if they,
unapologetic.
Yeah,
you were saying people really, I really kind of dislike these people. And it is quasi-religious. So what I get to in the article is there is this quasi-religious notion that people who have a bigoted past must repent in a quasi-religious way. And even secular people embrace this Abrahamic morality where they have to put everything into categories of good versus evil. So there are major flaws with our society's like philosophy and how we look at morality. And maybe some people do need a kind of a rigid moral system. Like, maybe it's a very elitist, high IQ way of looking at things, but maybe proles do need the more Abrahamic, strict good versus evil morality.
My views are similar. It sounds condescending, but I
think it is healthier to kind of accept that people go for these phases, which are necessary phases for development, and the process to be another person. And I also reference Alan Watts's way of looking at it, how we're basically like we're actors and we play these different roles depending on the circumstances that we're in different stages in life.
Yeah,
and
no,
I
know,
like, you think
I've read some
we
of
want
Watts,
to
but I,
think
yeah.
people have we want to think people have free will, but how much of our actions are shaped by our psychology, our demographic background, and the circumstances that we're in and the role that society grants us. Like, could
it's
if people
substantial.
want to say
Yeah.
that if they had a do-over, they may have done things differently, but it's just people just sort of need to kind of accept that. And I think it would actually make people a little actually less racist to think this way.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
people like so the Abrahamic morality is like it says racism is an evil, but then it creates this reactionary response like I don't like this outgroup. I think they're evil. It's like everyone, if you think of people as just sort of taking on roles based on their upbringing, their genetics, biology, and the situation they're in life, like you feel less of a need actually to hate people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is a kind of, I don't know what this term is to everyone, but there's a kind of clear pill about that where you're not leaning too far into some story you have about yourself and about other people, and instead are just, it's like the opposite of, what's the opposite of? I mean, I guess it's not the opposite of prejudice, but it's trying to avoid having, you know, I don't know. Sorry, I'm talking myself down a strange path here. You're just trying to be as honest and clear as possible with the things that are motivating people, and recognizing that they're going to motivate people. Recognizing that not everyone is engaging in some
and
platonic dialectic where
what people
they
do subconsciously, which ironically, like the woke implicit bias gets into. but people don't understand. People just say, like, I'm, like you said towards the beginning of the show, like, I'm doing this for the truth and justice. Like, that's what people think. But people don't think, like, how much, like, subconscious motives, things like social status, like, how much that influences decisions, people's politics. And I think, especially when you're younger, you're so caught up in the emotions, you're less aware of that. And that, I mean, that kind of political philosophy is something I put forth. I think it needs to be a new philosophical, like, political framework, but it, the problem is it just takes people who are just very highly intelligent, high in openness, which unfortunately I don't think it will really take off. But it's really, it's different. It's actually, it's different than the rationalist approach. Like, I wouldn't say,
no, I'm, not yet. It's not,
I feel
quite
very
same.
Different. Actually, I actually have major disagreements with, and in some ways, like, dislike for rationalism. It's different from
me
that.
Too. I think that, you know, and I wonder how Hanania feels about rationalism, because in some ways, some of his views resemble it a bit, but I don't think he's quite exactly that either. I think rationalism sort of became its own sort of in-group, you know, atheistic signaling, kind of how rational you are, taking it too far sort of group. But you know, the original intentions behind it of trying to apply more detached logic and reasoning to things are worthwhile, and I think those are in dialogue with, you know, the kind of politics you engage in, where you're trying to be, you know, kind of clear and rational about things. But one of the things that you have to be clear and rational about is the high degree to which people are not clear and rational. And I guess maybe that's what differentiates you, maybe, and Hanania, you know, from the rationalists. I mean, I guess there's always been a sort of, there's been a right-wing strain within rationalism, but most of them are kind of more center-right.
Okay, like, my issue with Hanania is he's sort of, runs into a lot of the same issues of the establishment. So I like Hanani. I'm not dissing him. I'm just saying, like, a major disagreement is he's kind of does this whole thing that the neoliberals do, where they're social Darwinists, but then they try, people who are, say, losers of the American, like, neoliberal or capitalist bureaucratic system, those who become bitter and bigoted about it, he places, like, negative moral judgment on those people. So I think Hanania does actually, he actually does that, which American society does at large.
What, kind of apply judgment?
Yeah, I think he actually does.
Yeah, I mean, I yeah, no, I wouldn't necessarily disagree, having seen his Twitter.
I guess the other thing about psychology, and it gets a bit almost like quasi Jungian or Gnostic, is I feel like I had the same views I have now
as a
teenager, but I just couldn't articulate them or have the courage to truly embrace them. But I feel like my views, actually, they were there all this time, since maybe not since I was born, but maybe since at least adolescence.
Yeah, I really like that. I do think it's quasi Jungian or something. Do I feel the same way about myself? Actually, not necessarily, but I do think, from what I know about you and you as a younger person, that sounds accurate. And it may be true in my case, too. I mean, views writ large, as you write in the article, depend a lot on context. They evolve over time. You know, things that you wouldn't even have had to have a view on in the 90s, you have to have a view on now. Whether it's the interaction, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example of this. You know, for certain foreign policy type of views, like, wouldn't even come up if there wasn't a conflagration, et cetera, et cetera. They're always changing. But what I do think maybe is a bit more immutable, maybe not so far as to say you're born with them, although you can get into,
well, something
sort of
like the fusion. Okay, so the fusion of, like, enclavism with multiculturalism and urbanism.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking about that stuff when I was in high school, but I wasn't able to articulate it.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is the immutable thing is, like, the deep level values, I think. I think the things that spark joy, the things that spark inspiration for life, are very often, if not exactly the same, that at least very much in dialogue
from a young age
with what you end up doing when you're older. And they may, the physical, the way they manifest in the world probably will change, but maybe deep down it's the same thing. And to some extent, that might imply that one's political views, especially if they're deeply held, are also kind of in there and only in need of unpacking to get in touch with.
I think before we wrap up, one thing I would like to touch upon is like the concept of elitism,
yeah,
and how elitism should be deciphered and how kind of Hanania pushes it. Because he definitely is a neoliberal, like, economic elitist.
Yeah. it's funny. Like, a lot of us are elitists, but we have different views. I mean, I would basically
maybe
identify as an elitist.
If you don't have power and wealth to back it up, like, is it a cope? That's another question.
It often is. I think there's a health. I think anyone who's right of center, which, you know, myself, and I know you wouldn't necessarily, but I would put you in this category, Robert, despite having extremely nuanced views. I do think you're ultimately right of center. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but definitely Spencer and definitely Hanania and definitely, you know, Curtis Yarvin, name your person. I think having some belief in hierarchy and inequality, and that some, you know, that there's like a select that you know, that not everyone should rule, that people have different roles in society, and there's a hierarchy within society,
yeah,
and within nature.
I
think that's the bread and butter of
perhaps I am philosophically right wing.
I would say so. I've always thought as much, and I think being an egalitarian or an elitist is key to that. But I do think there's so many different ways, you know, as many people as I've just named and as many people as been named
because
on this show,
I think when I got
there are
into,
different ways of getting
when I
to
got
that.
Into
yeah.
populism, I think populism, even right-wing populism, they do share a kind of a leftist obsession with fairness.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah, I agree that populism is a strange sort of hybrid creature where there's an element of that lefty thing, but like right-wing populism, certainly in the Trump era, is also like, is specifically wanting a strong leader and sort of you know, you reflecting your power in that leader. So it's not as like, it is still, you know, hierarchy oriented. So it's still right wing, but I agree. It's a strange hybrid creature of the one.
And then obviously like economic elitism tends to have like anti-aristocratic functions in the culture. That's true.
What do you mean by economic elitism? Like being economically right wing, like laissez-faire, like only, you know.
Yeah, I can.
Yeah.
So like those who sell the most product to the masses become the wealthiest, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I mean,
with
it's
mass democracy, who wins the most votes from the masses gets elected. Like they have these. Yeah. So yeah, like capitalism and democracy both have like these anti-aristocratic functions.
Yeah, they end up having that, although I think, as you well know, you know, there's always these shades of gray along the way, right? Like, yes, purely laissez-faire economics, yes, but also you have examples. I'm not sure if it's still cool to, like, bring up Elon Musk as an example, but, you know, a lot of these business people who have done very well within the current capitalist system are nevertheless sort of pro-aristocrat or pro bringing back some of that mentality, so...
Well,
yes, I think that
Twitter has gotten like there is more free speech, but it's also gotten really trashy too. Like
it
all
has.
All of the stuff that's promoted in the algorithms. And I guess the question is like, is that the trade-off to having free speech is to just have a really trashy Twitter?
Probably. Yeah. And bringing up Elon, I didn't even mean to give him a job review on Twitter. I just meant that like he is pro-capitalist, but also seems to have the sensibility that it can't just be about money. Like, you know, sometimes money can be corruptive, other times it can, you know, Peter Thiel is another example. Peter Thiel is basically a libertarian kind of economic, you know, he has a kind of libertarian economic orientation, but also ostensibly a sort of more pro-aristocratic orientation. So I don't think these things are flatly opposed to each other, but I do agree with you in principle that the way it plays out is often counter aristocratic.
Do you know if it does Hanania? I don't know if he gets. I mean, I don't know if he gets teal bucks. I have no clue. But it wouldn't.
I doubt it,
me.
But it wouldn't surprise
it
me.
Wouldn't surprise
I mean,
me.
He's
if he did.
Kind of a different
he is
flavor
kind
of libertarian, but
maybe Yarvin is more aligned with Teal. I think.
I,
teal,
yeah,
I mean,
certainly
Teal
they
has
were friends,
like anti-democratic views.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Anania posted this chart, and it shows you what populism is. So he says the left wing hate the rich and the powerful, but they don't hate the other, and the right wing hates the other, but they don't hate the rich and the powerful. And then the populists hate both the rich and the powerful, and they hate the other, and the opposite. He leaves the opposite empty, but I guess that would be like the neoliberal centrist.
Like him,
like,
I guess.
He basically, yeah. He is. And I don't know, like, in the past, I think I would have been, I think I had a phase in the past where maybe I would have been that person who leans towards hating the rich and powerful and hating the other, the populist. But I don't know where I am now. I think now I'm maybe right in the center, but maybe tilted slightly in the populist direction, but more in the center. Right there.
Yeah, and an interesting question is, where would I put myself?
I suppose I could, chart.
I did, yeah, because you put it in the article. I suppose it's wouldn't be a bad answer to put myself in the exact same position. I mean, having a healthy skepticism of both is good. That being said, my views don't align that much with Anania, but I will say
my views
didn't
do like a big. Yeah. They didn't do like an opposite. They sort of are in the general similar direction, but they became more level-headed and more refined.
Yeah, I think that's good, and I think to an extent that's Anania as well. I was just gonna say, like, I kind of get where he's coming from too, despite having my own disagreements with his views. I mean, there is something very kind of big-brained about saying, like, I'm going to make my peace with the powers that be, and I'm going to make my peace with the outsider and try and make the most of it. But then you also get, you know, as people have rightly criticized Anania for, he's kind of like quasi pro slavery or quasi pro, like, you know, people working for nothing to improve the life, you know, so there's like issues.
I think he also supports euthanasia.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have a strong bone to pick with that, I guess. But, you know, you're never going to escape ugly. You're never going to escape ugly extensions of your views, pretty much no matter where you are, which is why, you know, it can be a cop out, but I don't think in your case it's a cop out, Robert, because I think you really think through these things. I think, the center is a good place to be.
Do you think some of the hatred, like hatred of the rich, and those class-based narratives, both from the right-wing and left-wing populism, like, the question is, how much is it based in real, like, justice and the truth, and how much is it kind of a cope based on envy? And Anania would say it's a cope based on envy. But again, I think it often is, but again, it requires a lot of nuance.
It requires a lot of nuance. And I got to say, like, to the extent that I don't like the current rich and powerful in the world, which I would not say is a blanket statement, but out of the people that I dislike, you know, factions within the Democratic Party, at least, I'm really not envious of them. And I don't think I'm just saying that. I mean, I think they seem like lame people who just happen to have money and don't know what to do with it. I'm not saying I'm free of cope in my own views on things, but I think that you can take seriously the psychological insights of someone like Anania, and psychological insights of someone like you, Robert, might say that, you know, these things can be copes, and still say, like, at the end of the day, I also just, you know, I think I have a righteous resentment that's not based on coping of, you know, say, the wealthy class in California, et cetera. You know, it's not that these people are living so well and I'm jealous. It's that they have a lot of money, but they're still kind of scared, neurotic people who are not exactly taking us to the moon.
Before we wrap up, Matt, what do you want to say is, like, the essence of my politics and philosophy? Well, you could say in the past, but I'd say, like, especially now.
Yeah, like, what's the through line is maybe,
because I'm
your
not
question.
To be honest, I'm not that great. I can write extensive philosophical and political articles, but I'm not that great at just summarizing my views in like a paragraph. So if you want to go for it, if you can.
I don't want to rehash too much old territory or act like you haven't continued to evolve since this time, because you certainly have. But in 2017, in 2018, when we first started talking, you know, bracketing the idea of alt center, whatever that is, that's just a point on the political compass that you may or may not identify with. I mean, I do think the best two words, the best two words to summarize your philosophy are the same best two words that summarize Nietzsche, and I would also throw Crowley in there, which is aristocratic radicalism. I think that your views are aristocratic in the sense that the people, you have a view that the people with the best taste should be at the top and should be calling the shots. Now, is the best taste subjective? To a degree, it is subjective. But I think that, to a degree, of course, it's subjective, but I think that your views hold something to the effect of, how to put this? He who can kind of see the most clearly and sort of embrace beauty the most clearly and produce and support beauty the most clearly should rule. Is, you know, it's kind of like Blackstone in your book would be this sort of Jungian extension of you, Robert. And you'd say that summarizes his politics pretty well, right? You know, why the...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it'd be too easy to say. I mean, I think when I say something like aristocratic radicalism, most people will just kind of know what I mean. But the reason I get into beauty and stuff is because I'm trying to unpack that further. I mean, what is the true aristocratic vision? It's a view of nature that is unsentimental and that appreciates the true beauty that flows through nature, untrammeled by you know, moral story. I mean, I'm getting waxing a little Nietzschean here, but you know, moral stories we tell ourselves. No, it's an embrace of the grist, the real grist of life. I'm waxing too poetic here, but I think that, you know, your views are very much animated by that real sort of lust for life and lust for aesthetics that is so often made to play second fiddle to more quotidian earthly concerns. I don't know. Does that resonate, or I'm just doing my best? Yeah.
I'll take it.
You'll take it. Aristocratic radicalism. You know,
be like this, going this other direction of like a sort of Andrew Yang, like technocrat, who sort of manages like social status, but in a sort of quasi bureaucratic way? Like, could that be like a whole other direction?
Yeah, that could be a whole other direction. So that direction of your thought, which comes out in an idea like enclavism. Okay, so as in your thought, as in all of our thought, there's a dialectic. There's things that are in tension. I think the aristocratic radical aspect is one aspect, and it's maybe the most central aspect. It's what drew me to you. But you also try to think through things pragmatically, which is a little bit more of a managed. I guess this would be quasi the more left wing element of your views. You know, doing a more sort of distributive management of people's deep level needs based on your own, you know, sharper than most psychological insights.
To that whole like esoteric oral like,
it does apply. So do you have a kind of a more?
That's kind of tongue in cheek.
It's tongue in something. But that you bring up
a
good point.
I don't want to take this show in a crude tangent, but it is taking these dichotomies about social status and sexuality and making them kind of like a blatant arrangement, like how to manage social status better. It illustrates.
Yeah, I think
it's kind of, maybe it's kind of degenerate, but it illustrates social status like structures perfectly.
Yeah. It does illustrate them well. And, you know, going back to like, the, you know, were your views in you and you just had to chisel away at them like the artist chiseling away at marble to find the statue?
I probably thought about that a really long time ago, too.
You definitely did. I think Robert, I think what was instilled young was your sense, not to be too corny about it, but your sense of beauty and your it is sexual, you know, your sense of pleasure and what is the most sort of precious and worthy of lust in this life.
Social status, sexuality, yeah. Mysticism, spirituality, politics, sociology. I think I said aesthetics, like all these things, they intersect. It is intersectional.
They do intersect.
I'm a woke.
Intersectionalist.
I talk about I'm an intersectionalist. I'm a woke intersectionalist.
Yeah. So well,
talk
no,
about
yeah.
being woke, being, getting out of your subconscious, embracing, finding these hidden truths. I'm a woke person. I'm a woke Chad.
Yes. Yeah. That's how you a woke Chad centrist. That's how you end the article. I just waxing. You've asked me, you know, what? How do I summarize your views? And I'm not doing the best job of being succinct about it. But I'm thinking of different reference points. And another classic Robert Stark reference point is Yukio Mishima, and that's a great example of someone who you know was at the intersection of sexuality, homosexuality in his case, as you know, as it were, with politics and with you know.
But we don't.
Another
need,
good example of a young man.
I think it also has. There's an element of Freudianism. It's interesting because it's always the stereotype is that the leftists are the Freudians, and they say the leftists like to say, "Oh yeah, the conservatives." They're doing this because they're sexually repressed. So maybe they're sexually repressed and they're unsatisfied by their wife. So they channel that into hating gay people. Like that's standard Freudian leftist. But I mean, that's true. But I think a lot of the stuff I talk about is actually very, it's very Freudian. Very,
I mean, it's more Jungian than Freudian, but you know, if the shoe fits and
I don't know.
No, I just wanted to say
more,
like,
you think it's more Jungian or. It's more Jungian, but how much do you think it's Jungian and how much do you think it's Freudian?
I don't think you can fully separate the two because Jung was Freudian, but Jung took it in a more mystical...
He took it in a more mystical direction.
Yeah, which is more...
They both talk a lot about the subconscious.
They both talk a lot about the subconscious. They both... You know, Freud... So Freud, the type of Freudianism you're talking about is like... you know, projecting onto other people, like your own views and tensions
and
you find in the world.
I do think it's legitimate, actually.
It's completely legitimate. I mean, there's a reason that's an element of Freudianism that has, you know, there's so much that is rejected of Freud, but we all talk about projection, you know, as if it's not, but that concept is almost entirely from Freud. You know, Jung rejected certain elements of Freud, but projection was not one of those elements he rejected. So it's Jungian and it's Freudian. But just to finish the thought, you know, I think in your views, kind of like Mishima, there's this great thing that was instilled at a young age, this appreciation for beauty and this lust for life. That's your aristocratic radicalism. The other element, the more distributive element, is I think a kind of noblesse oblige that you feel like if you're going to have these views that are inspired by the things that you are kind of inspired by in the world, you also have to kind of come up with a system for how everyone can benefit from it. So it's
it's not egalitarianism, but it is about having some better resource allocation. So
because there's a need.
Technocracy. So like I say I hate bureaucracy and technocracy, but then I sound. These ideas could end up being very technocratic. So again, like it's all, there are these like themes you have to figure out where they contradict each other and they find these right balance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little more libertarian than you probably, but I can understand how, you know, I can understand why you're not because, you know, without, because so much when it's left on its own ends up ugly, I guess, as it were. So it's good because I too dislike bureaucracy and technocracy. So, you know, it's a dance between these things, but it's one that you'll continue to engage in. You know, when you're talking about like how you get reflexive about your own enclavism, about how
and also
maybe
like the archetype of the artist,
the
artist archetype. You think of them as being a lefty, but it can get like a fascistic archetype where they have a very clear vision of how the world should be, how it should look.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, these things will continue to evolve.
I mean, I don't really have anything else to add. I want to try to add on something grandiose. Like, I hope these ideas, like how will these ideas be implemented into politics? But I want to say something like that. But I think that kind of ruins the creative process. Like, I I think saying stuff like that, like we did on early shows, ruins the spontaneity, the creativity of all this stuff. And
I think
it's
agree.
A discussion that needs to be had. And I'll just say plug the article. It's on my Substack, and it's called Contrasting My Political Journey with That of Richard Hanania, How I Became Who I Am as a Woke Chat Centrist. You can find that on my Substack.
Recommend it for anyone to read. It's very.
If you want to add any last words.
No, just that I second that, that people should read that. It's something that will be interesting to people who are interested in some of these heterodox political ideas. But I would also say it's interesting to anyone who's interested in the intersection of psychology and politics and life in America in the 20th leading into 21st centuries, and how, and specifically life in California and Los Angeles too.
That's,
if you want
to
read an honest
point.
Account of that, this article is that.
Yeah, that's a key point, is putting psychology and social status more into politics. I think one last thing is, Matt, you have an upcoming publishing project that you don't have a release date, but that you're working on, if you want to plug. And if you do that, I'm going to republish both of my novels.
Yeah, I am doing that. It's, I guess, you know, I don't know how many people will listen to this, but I don't think there's no NDA from Mr. Dan Baltic and I's corner. So we're starting a press called New Ritual Press. Terror House, it'll be kind of similar to what Terror House was / is, in terms of publishing fiction. And that's really all I want to say about it for now. But I do want to, republish
the book,
Vapornia.
It is pretty relevant to everything basically everything we discussed. I mean, I don't want to say it's autobiographical. I don't want to say that, but I mean, everything we discussed is in the fiction novel.
I would agree. Yeah, and people should read that. You know, it's your work of art and sums it up really well, and on an emotional level, that as good as these Substack articles are, you know, I always direct people towards your fiction as well, and it will be given a second life, 2025 with this new press we're working on.
Matt Pegas, really, really great having this discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I loved the article. I'm glad you wrote it. I felt very proud and excited when I read it yesterday. And I'm glad that we could have this chat. Let's do it again soon sometime. I know there's some buzzing about us doing an election show, which you're not truly enthusiastic about, because, as you kind of mentioned earlier, this is not exactly your year to be super jazzed. But it's still worth doing for old time's sake.
I've already done an election show, but I'm open to it. I have a very passive attitude about this election, where I'm sort of. It kind of is kind of relevant, like, I feel very passive. Like, I'm almost just kind of watching politics as, like, an outside observer. Like, I'm just not that emotionally invested.
Fair enough, but I do
plan on writing a short article summarizing my final thoughts on the election.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to that, and, let's record again soon, but...
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.